From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the great and good of Washington, led by the US Vice President, gathered to pay their respects to Nelson Mandela.
President Mandela taught us that trust is possible, reconciliation is possible, justice is possible, change can come.
Also today, we get the latest from the Ukrainian protests as security forces fail to dislodge demonstrators. We talk to the congressional staffer who quit her job to fight against her mother's deportation. And the shambolic appearance of the sign language interpreter at Nelson Mandela's memorial service in Johannesburg.
He was just moving or waving his hands in the air. That is what we witnessed. He wasn't using South African sign language.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Washington and London have suspended all non-lethal assistance for the Syrian opposition in the war-torn countries north. The decision follows an attack by Islamist rebels who took control of several bases belonging to the Free Syrian Army. From Washington, Nina Maria Potts reports.
The U.S. says humanitarian assistance to the Syrian opposition will not be affected, but all non-lethal aid to fighters in the north will be suspended, this following the takeover of bases run by the Free Syrian Rebel Army by the Islamic Front, which is a new coalition of major rebel groups. They declared last month that they were forming the biggest alliance yet in the conflict, with an estimated 45,000 fighters at their disposal. The U.S. is now checking the inventory status of U.S. equipment and supplies to Syrian rebels as the humanitarian crisis continues to get worse.
The world continues to mourn Nelson Mandela. Thousands of South Africans have been lining up to view the leader's body, which is lying in state in Pretoria. He will be put to rest on Sunday in the village of his ancestors. In the U.S. Capitol, working in conjunction with the South African Embassy, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and a reverend are leading a memorial service for Mr. Mandela at the Washington National Cathedral. And meanwhile, criticism has been falling on yesterday's memorial service in Johannesburg, as many are accusing the man who acted as translator for the deaf as a fake, saying the gestures he made were both meaningless and offensive. In a major blow for gay rights advocates, India's Supreme Court approved a law that criminalizes same-sex intimacy, effectively undoing the 2009 ruling from the Delhi High Court, which had decriminalized the actions. The approved law is over a century old, and it says that those caught can face up to 10 years behind bars. Activists say they're outraged and determined to fight back. Negotiators have abandoned their goal of reaching a year-end trade deal among a group of nations in the Asia-Pacific during a round of negotiations in Singapore. Analysts cite significant resistance from sectors in the U.S. and Japan for creating the drag, as Daniel Wrenches reports.
The 12 nations have adjourned the trade talks in Singapore and abandoned the goal to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal done by year's end. U.S. officials say there's still great momentum for a deal. Pacific nations, including New Zealand, Australia, Peru, and Vietnam, want to essentially reduce or eliminate trade tariffs and establish strong rules for trade among the members, including the protection of intellectual property and fair competition. But analysts say there are still barriers to overcome, particularly political pressure to retain industry-specific tariffs.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. National Transportation Safety Board has begun its hearings into the crash of Asiana Flight 214. The botched landing in San Francisco's airport in July left three teenagers dead. The NTSB is looking into whether there was an over-reliance on the use of autopilot involved in the crash. In Argentina, several cities have broken into chaos as violent looting spread during a police strike. At least 10 people died and many others were injured as police left their posts demanding a salary increase. The violence erupted as political leaders celebrated 30 years of uninterrupted democracy in their country. Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
Officers in 19 of the 23 provinces in Argentina refused to patrol the streets, a strike which set the stage for mobs to take over the cities, looting shops and robbing homes. Commerce was shut down in most places, and some hospitals also shut their doors to non-emergency patients for fear of being attacked. But meanwhile, Argentina celebrated 3 decades since President Raúl Alfonsín's inauguration put an end to the dirty war years, which were marked by state terrorism against political dissidents. Argentina's president, Cristina Fernández, was part of the festivities and has not yet commented on the violence. Her cabinet chief, Jorge Capitanich, described the unrest as treason meant to spread chaos and fear during a day when the country commemorates its return to democracy. Nevertheless, he is working with police forces to negotiate a deal.
And violence and protests continue over the Ukrainian prime minister's decision to back away from signing a deal with the EU. Clashes broke out as police moved against protesters near Kiev City Hall. Talks have also been held between Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych and the European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The people of the United States of America mourn today with the people of South Africa for the loss of a truly, truly extraordinary man. The most impressive man or woman I've ever met in my life.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden addressing a packed National Cathedral in the capital today for a special memorial service. After events in Johannesburg, it was Washington, D.C.'s turn to celebrate the life of former South African President Nelson Mandela. Along with Mr. Biden, congressional members, civil rights leaders and schoolchildren attended to pay their respects. FSN's Lorna Shattuck was also there and described a sense of celebration.
Absolutely an amazing atmosphere here at the National Cathedral in Washington, high on a hill above the city itself on a really beautiful, cold, sparkling, sunny day. People have turned out from the vice president downwards, really. We've seen the greater the good of Washington society here, but also school children and ordinary people keen to pay their respects to Nelson Mandela. And it's really been an amazing atmosphere of music, dancing, clapping, a real celebratory feeling to this. To this celebration and to this service. We began with a call to prayer from various different faith traditions, Jewish, Muslim and Christian, from local clerics. The South African National Anthem was sung, as well as, of course, the U.S. National Anthem. Poems have been read, folk songs sung. There's been a reading from the Quran and a lot of gospel singing. As I said, clapping, cheering, whooping going on in the audience. It's really been an amazing thing to witness here.
You mentioned the vice president. What role did Joe Biden play in today's ceremony?
Well, Vice President Biden gave the tribute on behalf of the government of the United States. President Obama, of course, gave his tribute in South Africa itself at that service in the FNB Stadium in Johannesburg on Tuesday. But Mr. Biden was able to tell his own personal stories of Nelson Mandela and how when he met him, he saw and noticed that Nelson Mandela dreamed the world another way, and he talked to Nelson Mandela as the most inspirational person he'd ever met. He also spoke of his experiences as a senator visiting South Africa under apartheid and being separated off from African American members of the delegation because the apartheid rules were still very much in force, and that was something that he rebelled against. But he spoke of justice, reconciliation and truth being things that were taught to the U.S. And to people worldwide by President Nelson Mandela. He said he taught us that change can come.
And this service was apt for many reasons, but in particular the long, deep and at times complex relationship between the late South African president and Washington.
That's right. Washington certainly not had a completely happy relationship with South Africa and with Nelson Mandela. It was, Washington that refused under President Reagan to impose sanctions on the apartheid regime. But in more recent years, certainly President Bill Clinton has had an extremely good relationship with Nelson Mandela. They were personal friends. Barack Obama, of course, has spoken of how he found Nelson Mandela a personal inspiration. It was as a 19-year-old student at Occidental College in Los Angeles that he was first that galvanised to get involved in politics by two ANC envoys who spoke of the iniquities of apartheid, and that's what stirred Barack Obama to get involved in political activities. He gave his first public political speech in 1981, in fact, on apartheid, calling for action against it. So certainly Washington, as a political entity, particularly has a good relationship with Mandela, but also as a city. This is a city with over 50% black population. Many people here feel that Nelson Mandela is an adopted American civil rights hero.
Lorna Shaddick at the Washington Cathedral. And as the US Capitol marked the death of Nelson Mandela, the former South African president's memorial service in Johannesburg was still generating headlines, but mostly due to the widely criticised presence of a sign language interpreter whose hand signals were described by the watching deaf audience as utter gibberish. For more reaction to the incident, I spoke to deaf member of the South African Parliament, Wilma Neuhout-Druschen.
We saw, obviously, while they were standing on the stage, all the dignitaries were on the stage, and the program director was making the announcements as to who was present. The interpreter that was standing on the stage next to the program director, that's the person who we are calling as a fake interpreter. On my screen, when I watch television, in the left-hand side, in the corner, you will find that there is a square, and that there are sign language interpreters in that square, but they are providing sign language service through the South African broadcaster. And we were focusing on those interpreters. Unfortunately, when the broadcast was done overseas, you people or the international community wouldn't see those interpreters in the left-hand corner. They would only see the interpreter on the stage, and that is, we got a glimpse of him. We saw him at times when he was on the stage with the program director.
A man who appeared to provide sign language interpretation on stage at Nelson Mandela's memorial service. What aspects of his role as an interpreter triggered this criticism?
Well, he wasn't using sign language. The sign language that we know here in South Africa. You know, the finger spelling, the facial expressions, the body language. He was using absolutely nothing. He was just moving or waving his hands in the air. That is what we witnessed. He wasn't using South African sign language. Therefore, the deaf community was totally outraged. He wasn't using any sign language at all.
Clearly, South Africa has professional interpreters. Ronel, who we're using for this very interview, is an example of that. So how did a person as unqualified as this man find himself in such an important, vital position?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know who he is. I don't even know his name. But yes, sometimes government will maybe send out a tender. I don't know how he got there. But they did not contact the Deaf Federation of South Africa. I, myself, am the vice chairperson of the Deaf Federation of South Africa, a deaf organization here in South Africa. And we've never been contacted about him as a person or as a sign language interpreter. So we have no idea as to where they got him, where they found him, how he got into that position. And yes, we do have qualified sign language interpreters here in South Africa. We have them here, but why they were not called, you know, or contacted, we have no idea. So we don't even know how he got that position.
Wilma Neuhout-Druschen, deaf member of the South African Parliament. After months of closed-door negotiations, Republicans and Democrats reached a deal last night on a budget for the next 2 years, which, if it passes both chambers of Congress, would avoid the threat of another government shutdown. But the proposed budget, which allocates over $1 trillion in spending for 2014 and 2015, is already getting attacked from the left and right. Conservative groups are opposing the deal for increasing government spending in the short term, while some progressives say it's immoral to leave out funding for unemployment benefits, which are set to expire for more than 1 million long-term jobless people in just a few weeks. On Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein has the story.
The main authors of the budget deal that must now pass both chambers of Congress say the arrangement includes provisions that will appeal to everyone.
As a conservative, I think this is a step in the right direction. What am I getting out of this? I'm getting more deficit reduction. So the deficit will go down more by passing this than if we did nothing. Point number two, there are no tax increases here.
That's Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan, who joined Washington State Democrat Patty Murray to announce the results of their committee's months of negotiations.
Our deal puts jobs and economic growth first by rolling back sequestrations, harmful cuts to education and medical research and infrastructure investments and defense jobs for the next 2 years.
But the proposal is already drawing fire from all sides, both for what it does and what it fails to do. Powerful conservative think tanks and advocacy groups, including the Club for Growth, Heritage Action, FreedomWorks, and Americans for Prosperity, have come out against the budget because it restores about $63 billion that would have been cut from military and domestic programs. House Speaker John Boehner lashed out at those groups for their opposition at a press conference Wednesday.
You mean the groups that came out and opposed it before they ever saw it?
Yes, those groups. Are you worried that
they're using our members and they're using the American people for their own goals? This is ridiculous.
Progressive lawmakers and analysts say they're also concerned with several provisions in the budget. Under this deal, federal workers hired next year and beyond will have to contribute more to their retirement benefits, while newly retired military veterans will have to shoulder reduced cost of living adjustments to their benefits starting next year.
Federal workers, due to sequester, have already actually sacrificed a great deal. Furloughs and uncertainty of budgeting and a government shutdown.
That's Joe Comerford with the National Priorities Project. She said having a budget deal is better than risking another government shutdown, but criticized the negotiators for, quote, staying within the framework of austerity, while at the same time protecting corporate tax loopholes and a massive and growing military budget.
Because of this bipartisan agreement, overall military spending or Pentagon spending will actually rise $2 billion based on where it would have been without the deal. Domestic spending will continue to feel cuts, although not at the level that they would have been without this bipartisan deal.
The bill also leaves out funding for the long-term unemployed, an omission New York Representative Nita Lowey and other House Democrats called immoral.
I think it is absolutely urgent that we restore and continue the unemployment insurance benefits. It is absolutely outrageous that we should leave this Congress and go home for the holidays when too many people, over a million people, will not be getting their unemployment benefit.
Speaker Boehner told reporters Wednesday that he would only support extending unemployment insurance if it's paid for with budget cuts elsewhere, while Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid announced on the Senate floor that he won't bring forward a bill to extend the benefits until after Congress returns from vacation, essentially admitting that they will allow the benefits for 1.3 million people to expire on December 28th. Reid did not say whether a bill passed in January would retroactively reimburse those whose benefits were cut off. The budget deal, which the House will try to pass this week, also does nothing to address the debt ceiling, which the government is on track to breach in mid-February. In Washington, I'm Alice Ulstein.
The Ukrainian protests paralyzing the center of the capital, Kiev, are showing no signs of ending after security forces clashed with demonstrators in a failed attempt to dislodge the activists. The protests, heading now into a third week, began when President Yanukovych turned his back on EU trade ties. Protests culminated on Sunday when hundreds of thousands of people poured into the centre of Kiev and toppled the city's statue of Vladimir Lenin. Our Moscow correspondent Tom Barton has been following events.
It's really been quite a drama, and there's been certain moments that have really caught the world's attention. with police beating protesters more than once in the past 2 weeks, which really swelled the size of those protests. A lot of angry people responding to that. What may have been otherwise smaller protests around the country's political crisis and really its direction of travel, as it were, whether it is towards Europe, towards Russia, or somehow treading a path between the two. And then again, dramatic scenes earlier today, in the pre-dawn darkness, the police trying to move in and break up protests and failing to do so.
Prior to those battalions of security forces making their way into Independence Square, we had a Western contingent of diplomats who came over to try and thrash out some sort of conclusion to this protest.
Yes, it follows a meeting between President Viktor Yanukovych and Vladimir Putin, which was his second meeting in recent weeks. And then we saw the arrival of Catherine Ashton, the EU's foreign policy chief, and also a US official. We've also seen other European politicians going and showing solidarity with the protesters. Catherine Ashton herself as well, after meeting with Mr. Yanukovych, went down to the central square in Kiev to have a look at things there. And it was only a few hours after she had been there that police tried to move in and break things up, which made her saddened, in her own words. It also fetched strong words from the US Secretary of State John Kerry, saying that he was disgusted by what he saw armed force being used against peaceful protesters. Although the police were trying generally to be more restrained, there were various reports that batons were still used, and that in international eyes from the EU and beyond, it was simply not necessary. They had come to try to talk to Mr. Yanukovych, to try and thrash out some negotiated solution to the country's political crisis after his U-turn and refusal to sign that association agreement with trade and reform with the EU. And it looks as though the authorities had tried just to shut things down with the protesters.
Finally, Tom, this protest movement, you could describe it as stubborn, persistent and dedicated, because they've been there for 2 weeks. They're battling a bitter Ukrainian winter, and there's no signs that security officers are able to dislodge them. They've set up camp. Is this going to be a protest that moves into the new year, potentially?
Before the police started to try and move in and clear certain areas, we saw pictures of snow settling on the heads of both the riot police helmets and also on the hats of the protesters. The whole thing was looking rather bleak, looking rather forlorn. Many of the protesters were warming their hands over braziers in that central square. But this has given them such a boost. What they are considering, the protesters, a massive victory in having chased the police out of the square and of City Hall. They are now, A, focused a lot more on saying it is now Viktor Yanukovych who must go. It seems that their wrath is primarily directed at him. And they also seem a lot more determined now. Large crowds gathering today in the central square in Kiev, a show of solidarity amongst these protesters. It seems now that they have been re-galvanised by what might be considered a rather bungled attempt to remove them, which has quite badly backfired.
FSN's Moscow correspondent Tom Barton. This is FSN Reports. As prospects for immigration reform grow dimmer during Congress's end-of-the-year scramble and President Obama refuses to take more executive actions to curb deportations, activists from across the country are ramping up political pressure. Erica Andiola quit her job as a congressional staffer so she can dedicate herself full-time to fighting her mother's deportation. Her mother and dozens of other activists travelled by bus from Arizona to DC and have been holding daily vigil protests aimed at convincing House Republicans to allow a vote on one of several stalled immigration reform bills. Erica told me how close her mother had come to being deported.
So what happened was that, I had the great opportunity to be able to get my work permit through something called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. you know, about 3 months later after I got it, I had the opportunity to go interview with a congresswoman, and she gave me the job as the outreach director for her office. And the same day,
Kirsten Sinema,
she's a representative from Arizona. The same day I had the interview, I went home and was ready to celebrate with my mom and my family, you know, the new job, my very first job with a work permit. And that same night, we got an unfortunate visit by ICE in my house. They came and knocked at the door, took my mom, took my brother, and, you know, who my brother was released right away, but my mom was about to be deported on a bus on the way to Mexico. And, you know, we had to do this huge campaign to be able to keep her home. We were, in fact, able to return the bus and bring her back home to Phoenix, where I live.
Right. But it's not necessarily a happy ending. I mean, this fight is still ongoing. Where does it stand at the moment?
We were just given a year to keep her here. And so, you know, this year almost expires in January. And so, you know, my thinking was that I don't want it to get to that point where we have to, like, return a bus again, right? I wanted to make sure that ICE keeps her here, and not just for a year. Like, I want her to be here and not be worried about every single year fighting her deportation.
You said you've learned from Washington that it's more about politics mm-hmm. than people. How did you arrive at that?
What I found was that there was two parties that were just basically thinking about the next election. And as much as I was telling my story, as much as I wanted for folks to come on board, they were really not really talking to each other. And I couldn't make that happen. I got really, really frustrated. Mm-hmm. And that was another reason why I decided, you know, maybe I have a lot more power on changing things from the outside than being in there just seeing all the nastiness of the politics that we're just kind of holding immigration reform hostage, and it has for like the past 10 years.
As you explained, you are a so-called dreamer and mm-hmm. a very high-profile one at that.
Yeah.
But how do you reconcile the fact that this Obama administration has been responsible for a record number of deportations?
Yeah, I just don't understand it. I really don't understand that. You know, we have, I guess, I would say, called them out on this many times for years now. And, you know, sort of the answer from the administration is that they support immigration reform, which is, you know, it's great. But you cannot make an excuse for the 2 million deportations that have happened. And to me, you know, in Congress, I was able to see that there were a couple of Democrats that really cared, that they were trying to do the right thing. Mr. Gutierrez from Illinois, he was one of the people that was really, really trying to reach across the aisle on a lot of this. And he would say, right, we have a Republican House right now. So if we want to get anything done, we need Republicans, period.
House Speaker Boehner last week said that he's going to hire an aide to tackle the immigration issue. Did that offer you some hope
then? Yeah, I mean, we're not letting him off the hook, right, that easily. Speaker Boehner has been, you know, horrible on this issue. You know, to me, it was like, if he needs the courage to tell us in our eyes what he wants to do with immigration.
To quote you, Congress is about politics, not people. So let's make it about people again. How is your mother, Maria?
She's, you know, she's very happy right now that, you know, things have been picking up a lot in her campaign, and we've been able to get a good number of signatures on her petition. She, after she came back from the detention and from all the, you know, everything that happened, she told me the story of being in there, being chained, literally, like, if she's 55 years old, she has just gone through cancer. She was detained. She gets chained. It was just a horrible experience. And just coming out of that, knowing that the community helped her so much, really empowered her. And so right now she's also an activist. She became, you know, an amazing activist from Arizona. And she's fighting her own deportation as well and working with undocumented mothers to empower them as well to do the same thing.
Erica Andiola. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show. Email us, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. Follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.